Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
All right, well, by the time this hits the internet, it'll be too late for this explanation, because this message probably won't hit the internet until Saturday, and then people will be going, where was the midweek service? Why didn't I get to hear it till Saturday? But I won't have a chance to work on it tonight, and in the morning, by noon, I'll be in the car on my way to Lexington. Tomorrow evening is Elder Ward's memorial service. I believe my friend Pastor Spickard here in Nashville is going to go with me, so he'll give me somebody to travel with. So we're going to go up there, and then Friday after the homegoing service, I'll be coming back, so I'll be back late Friday night. So it'll probably be Saturday before I can even touch this particular recording in order to get it up on our website. So when you're listening to this, internet people, when you're listening to this and saying, why was it late? Now you'll know what my explanation was for the lateness. Tonight we are in Exodus 18. Last time we saw the children of Israel, they were back in Rephidim. And then we had to talk about Amalek last week. Tonight we're going to get to the development of government within Israel. And then if we get through the material I want to get through and get all the way into them entering Sinai and Moses speaking to God at Sinai, we might even get a little bonus apologetics material, if you're good. Okay? So, yeah, I know. Yeah. So let's start at chapter 18, verse 1. Now, we're going to be reintroduced to Jethro. Anybody remember Jethro?
Yes.
That's the wrong one. Moses' father-in-law. Father of?
Zipporah.
Oh, my. What is Zipporah famous for?
Being mad at Moses
for what?
Circumcision.
For circumcision, exactly. The last time that we saw Zipporah, she was throwing the foreskin of her child at Moses' feet and saying, you are a bloody husband to me. And we're going to see tonight, Moses sent her back to her dad with the kids, two boys and Zipporah. Just go back to your father. And so, yeah, apparently that's an Old Testament option. Yeah, so, yeah.
It's a biblical precedent.
It's a biblical precedent, according to Alex in the back. And of course, there's been a fair amount of discussion about the why behind this. Remember, Moses wrote this book. And so he writes about Zipporah, and, you know, she said the bloody husband thing. And then you don't hear anything more about her because he went to Egypt and he delivered the Israelites and all that. And now, of course, he's back in this area where he was when he saw the burning bush in the first place, out in the wilderness where he first discovered Jethro, the priest of Midian, and his seven daughters, and met Zipporah and got married. That whole episode, and now he's back in that same area. Jethro, of course, has heard about everything Moses has been doing, because when you have a million people leave Egypt and work their way into the wilderness, that's news that's going to travel, especially if they're being led by a pillar of cloud and fire, and especially if they've gone through the Red Sea, and if the Egyptian army, which is the major threat to everybody living in that area, has been drowned in favor of these people that are moving through the wilderness, that's news that travels. And so Jethro has heard about it and found out that his son-in-law is leading these people, and so he comes and finds Moses to talk to him. And when he sees what Moses is doing every day, when he sees the undertaking that Moses is subjected to, where every day from sunup to sundown, all he's doing is listening to these people argue. From sunup to sundown, he has to deal with these people who, as we've seen, if we've seen anything consistently about these people, it's the nonstop complaining and murmuring and arguing. Well, they don't just argue against God. They're not just unhappy with God and complaining about meat or water or comfort or whatever else, but they complain against each other. They're constantly bickering and fighting with each other. And so they come to Moses. He has become their judge. And Jethro is going to say, this is too much work. No man can judge this many people all day, every day, you need help. And this is going to be the beginning of setting up judges over groups of people and setting up an actual form of judgment within Israel. And of course, as we work our way through the Old Testament, it's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and then Joshua,
Judges.
Because God's ultimate form of government for Israel was supposed to be a theocracy, God rule, and then he was going to put judges over them, as opposed to having a king, as opposed to somebody who was the authoritarian ruler. God was the ruler, and then there were going to be judges to keep those rules. So first Jethro is going to come and suggest to Moses that he start setting up a system of judges. And one of the things he's going to say to him is, you need to teach the dictates, the rules, the laws, and then let people judge those rules and laws. And then right from there, we get to chapter 19, which takes them to Sinai, and we're going to get into the giving then of the law, which are all the rules. So my point in all that is, big picture, before they get to Sinai, before Moses goes up on the mountain and receives the whole of the law and the Ten Commandments written in stone, first God has Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, come to him and convince him of a couple things. Number one, you've got to have more people helping you. You can't do it all yourself, Moses. And number two, you need to teach the rules and the statutes of God to the people. So first Moses is told you have to teach the rules and statutes, then he receives the rules and statutes, and by the time he's received them, there is already a system of judges set up in Israel so that the rules and laws of God can be properly dispersed throughout Israel. In other words, there's a whole wisdom to this working, where God is preparing these people for the idea that they're not just delivered and free, but they've been bought with a price, and therefore God has the right to impose rules on them. So let's start at chapter 18, verse 1. Now Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Moses' wife Zipporah after he, Moses, had sent her away, and her two sons, of whom one was named Gershom, for he had said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. And the other was named Eleazar, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness where he was camped at the Mount of God. And he sent word to Moses and said, I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons with her. And Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, and he bowed down and he kissed him. And they asked each other about their welfare, and they went into the tent. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and all the hardship that had befallen them on the journey, and how the Lord had delivered them. I've been emphasizing for the last couple weeks that there's a pattern to this, that God keeps taking Israel into these areas where problems are, takes them to places where there is no water, takes them to places where there is no food, and then after they have encountered the hardship and endured it for a while, God delivers them. So there's this steady pattern of God delivering and delivering and delivering. And so Moses recounts it not only to his father, but when he writes this book, he takes the time to write that again, that this pattern exists of God first bringing them into hardship and then delivering them. Verse 9, and Jethro rejoiced over all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel in delivering them from the hand of the Egyptians. So Jethro said, blessed be the Lord who delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of Pharaoh and who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods, small g, in other words, I know that Yahweh, capital L-O-R-D, or Jehovah, the God of the Israelites, is greater than all the small gods, the gods of Egypt. And indeed, it was proven when they dealt proudly against the people. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God, and Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law before God. And it came about the next day that Moses sat to judge the people. And the people stood around Moses from the morning until the evening. And when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he was doing for the people, he said, "What is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge, and all the people stand round about you from morning until evening?" And Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God. And when they have a dispute, it comes to me, and I judge between a man and his neighbor, and I make known the statutes of God and his laws." Now, how many statutes and laws are there so far?
Zero.
Well, there's a couple. Do everything that I said. Trust me. Those are kind of it.
Do it my way.
Do it my way. Exactly right. But are there the statutes and the rules that we're familiar with that we call the Law of Moses, the Sinai Law? Does any of that exist yet?
Nope.
Well, then we have to assume, since he said that the people come to me to inquire of God, that when they come to him and they bring their case to him, that somehow he is going inquiring of God so that he can come back and judge with some kind of proper judgment. There's some kind of interaction going on here because he mentions that the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, it comes to me, and then I judge between a man and his neighbor, and I make known the statutes of God and his laws. So it appears that these statutes, these laws, these rules for Israel are kind of being doled out piece by piece, little by little, through this process of judging, which is why it makes sense that it would at some point be codified, that at some point God would say, okay, let's set out the rules, and then take those rules to all of Israel, so that no longer are there questions piece by piece, bit by bit, day by day, what about this, what about that, but that God would set it, for lack of a better term, set it in stone and say, okay, these are the rules, this is the law. But at this point in Israel's history, the constant bickering, fighting, complaining necessitates constant judging. And through that process of judging, the necessity of rules, the necessity of a law is coming into play. And so it's no accident that the next thing God's going to do in chapter 19 is take them to Sinai and give them a law, because this seems to be what is consuming their life at this point. What are the rules? We're a community, we're a group, we got to learn to live together. What are the rules? So verse 17 says, Moses' father-in-law said to him, "The thing you are doing is not good. You will surely wear out both yourself and these people who are with you, for the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. Now listen to me. I shall give you counsel, and God be with you. You be the people's representative before God, and you bring the disputes to God. And then teach them the statutes and the laws, which are obviously going to be what God says back to you. Whatever God tells you is the resolution to the disputes, you come and teach it to the people and make it known to them the way in which they are to walk and the work that they are to do. And furthermore, you shall select out of all the people able men who fear God, men of truth, those who hate dishonest gain, and you shall place these over them as leaders of thousands, leaders of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens." So that there would be a system of government in place, but Moses would be the one who would obviously go to God, and then whatever God said back, he would then take to the people. Say, okay, here's God's reaction to this one. But you can see how if Moses is going with dispute by dispute to God and saying, okay, what about this one? An animal fell in a ditch, and it was on this other guy, and he didn't take it out of the ditch. Well, then does he owe him something? He takes that to God, and God says, okay, yes. If an animal's in a ditch, you're required to pull it out of the ditch. Okay, there's one more rule. Well, eventually in the law, we're going to get into 600 of these type of rules, these day-to-day living rules. Yes?
But these are how all the laws get started, all the way into Leviticus.
I believe that's why Moses is writing it the way he's writing it, is that God taking them to Sinai and giving them the law was not just, you know, a wing and a prayer and, hey, I got an idea. I mean, he was developing a society here. He was developing a nation. Remember, they've been slaves for 400 years. They've been told what to do by their slave masters for 400 years. Now you've taken them all out into the wilderness and you've said, okay, now cooperatively, the million of you have to work together. Well, right away, they're going to start arguing. They're going to start discoursing. You know, what do we do about these things? So they're coming to Moses, and Moses is going to God and saying, what about this? Okay, but what about this? What about that? Well, then, of course, God would codify an entire law for them. Here are my rules for you so that you can operate as a theocracy by God's rules, not by man's rules, not by your own judgment, not by what seems best. And that's why oftentimes people say, you know, the law, as you read through Leviticus and as you read through Deuteronomy, there are so many minor laws. There are so many little details and minutiae that people think, well, why was that so important? It was so important because he was giving all these rules to a group of people who were learning to become a society of people. And so everything counts. Every rule counts. So teach them the statutes and the laws and make known to them the way in which they are going to walk and the work that they're going to do. And furthermore, verse 21, you'll select out of all the people able men who fear God, men of truth and who hate dishonest gain. Why was it important that he point that out? Men who hate dishonest gain. Why would that be important? Yeah, so they can't be bribed. You don't want somebody who can take a little money and then rule unfairly in favor of one person or another. Verse 22, and let them judge the people at all times, and let it be that every major dispute they bring to you, but every minor dispute they themselves will judge. So it'll be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. And if you do this thing, and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all these people also will go to their place in peace. So Moses listened to his father-in-law, verse 24 says, and he did all that he had said. And Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. And they judged the people at all times. The difficult dispute they would bring to Moses, but every minor dispute they themselves would judge. Then Moses bade his father-in-law farewell, and he went his way into his own land. And that's the last we hear of Jethro. He disappears from the historic record. Also, by the way, outside of that reference of Jethro bringing Zipporah in, we don't hear any more about Zipporah either. What that means, I have no idea. I don't know if that means Zipporah went back with her dad, if she stayed there, we don't know. There's going to be a dispute later about the fact that Moses is going to take an Ethiopian wife, and his sister and brother aren't going to be happy about that fact. But as far as Zipporah, we don't know. So that takes us to chapter 19. In the third month, after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that very day, they went to the wilderness of Sinai. And when they set out from Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai, and they camped in the wilderness, and there Israel camped in front of the mountain. And Moses went up to God, up in the mountain, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the sons of Israel, you yourself have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. By the way, does that sound like there's a theology being developed there? Because there is. It's God speaking in the first person. You noticed what I did. I delivered you, and I brought you to myself. God never speaks of relationships with humans any other way. Yes?
Why did he put it that way? And this may be a dumb question. How did Jacob and house of Israel?
Well, they're synonymous terms at this point, but also Jacob is heel catcher. And as you go through the Old Testament, you'll see how frequently when God is chastising them, he reminds them of their name. You are Jacob. When he wants to remind them of their blessed state for having been chosen by God, he calls them Israel. And so those two terms are intertwined here when he says, you're the house of Jacob. Say to the house of Jacob and tell the sons of Israel. And so it's the same guy, Jacob, who had his name changed to Israel. They're the house of Jacob. They're the descendants of Jacob. but they're also the sons of Israel, prince who has power with God. So it's God pointing out, you're depraved people, but you're under my hand of blessing because I chose you. Which I think he obviously says in the next verse when he says, you yourself have seen what I've done for you and how I drew you to myself. They weren't responsible for any of that. Verse 5, now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And these are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel. Okay, so this is the moment where we're going to get a little bit of extra apologetic and exegetical bonus material. I almost couldn't say that.
You okay?
I'm okay. I had a stroke for a moment. That phrase is a very, very important phrase because that idea, kingdom of priests, is a promise to Israel. If you obey my voice, you will be a kingdom of priests. What does a priest do? What's the job or the function of a priest? Yeah, intercede between man and God. In other words, somebody who has access to the holiest place, somebody who can go into the tabernacle, somebody who can commune with God, that's a priest. Now, throughout Israel's history, they're always going to have priests. God is going to take the Levites to himself, and he is going to form the priesthood after Aaron, and he's going to have the high priest, always out of the lineage of Aaron. And nobody's able to come and talk to God or intercede between man and God, except the priests. But God's promise is, if you'll do things my way, I will make you a kingdom, and it'll be a kingdom of priests. So however else you want to delineate it, every man is going to be able to come before God on their own. So here's a promise given specifically to Israel. It's given to them when they're at Sinai before they've been given the law. And he says, you will be a kingdom of priests, the whole earth is mine, and you will be, very specific language, you'll be a holy nation. So Israel, out of all the nations on the planet, will be a holy nation before God. Now that same language is picked up by Peter in the New Testament. And as a consequence of Peter picking it up, a great deal of theology has grown from, well, why would Peter say this and what does he mean when he says it? So turn with me real quickly over to 1 Peter 2, starting at verse 9. Keep a bookmark there in Exodus and go to 1 Peter 2 and look at 9 and 10. Everybody there? So I want you to see this for yourself. Starting at, let's start at chapter 2, verse 1. Therefore, putting aside all malice and all guile, and all hypocrisy and envy and all slander, like newborn babes long for the pure milk of the word, that by it you may grow in respect to salvation. If you have tasted the kindness of the Lord, and coming to him as to a living stone, rejected by men, but choice and precious in the sight of God. Now you also, as living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For this is contained in the scripture. It says, behold, I lay in Zion a choice stone, a precious cornerstone, and he who believes in him shall not be disappointed. This precious value, then, is for those who believe. But for those who disbelieve, it is written, the stone which the builders rejected, he has become the very cornerstone. And also a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. For they stumble because they are disobedient to the word, and to this doom they were also appointed. Verse 9, but you, are a chosen race, a royal priesthood. In other words, a kingdom of priests. You are a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that you may proclaim the excellence of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Now, here's the way the theology grows from there, typically. They'll say, Peter's writing to the church here. And Peter, writing to the church, just said that a promise that was given to Israel in Exodus 19 is fulfilled in the church. And therefore, since the promise made specifically to Israel is now fulfilled in the Gentile church, this is yet again proof that the word Israel, the term Israel, the idea of Israel has changed in the new covenant so that the real Israel, the true Israel, is now the church because the church is receiving promises that were made to national Israel in the Old Testament. Understand the argument? Okay, what was wrong with that argument? Because I sure did make it well.
Peter was writing to Jews.
Boy, you're so good. You're so fast. You're like right there.
The pilgrims of the dispersion.
Peter was writing to the Jews. He was writing to the diaspora. He was writing to believing Jews. So did Peter actually say that the church of believing Gentiles are now a royal priesthood? No, he never said that. This is why it is so important to get your Israelology straight. That is why it is so important to know who's writing, who are they writing to, and then what did they say? Peter, John, and James' chief ministry was to whom?
Jews.
To the Jews, to the believing Jews, to believing Israelites. Peter, John, and James wrote to them. So then when Peter is writing to the diaspora, the believing Jews, he can say to believing Jews, remember that promise that Israel was given in the Old Testament? That they would be a royal priesthood, which means that they would be a kingdom. They would have a king. They would be under a king. Okay, Christ is now your king. He's ruling and reigning. You have a king. And you no longer need a priesthood. He's your high priest. And you are all priests in as much as you can go to God individually. And you can pray to God individually. You no longer need an intercessor. You no longer need the temple. You no longer need animal sacrifices. Because the redemptive price has been paid. And you all individually now act as a priest used to. Now, can he say that to Jewish believers and retain the distinction of Israel?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely he can. And that's what's really important, is that when he says it to people who the promise was made to in the first place. It is a fulfillment of a promise to people who had the promise in the first place. Confusion happens when you try to impose that promise on people Peter wasn't writing to. If you say Peter is writing to the Gentile church, then there is a lot of confusion because now you can start making all those arguments for, well, God has redefined Israel. Promises that were made to Israel in the Old Testament are clearly being fulfilled in the Gentile church. So what does that mean? What are the implications of that? And the implications are enormous. Had that been what happened. But that's why it's so important to recognize that Peter is very clear to say who he's writing to. And so he can say, you are a holy nation. You are a kingdom of priests, because they're the people that had the promise in the first place. Now, does that promise to believers in the first century, believing Jews in the first century, does that negate the future restoration of a kingdom that Christ is ruling over with Israel, when they will all know me from the least to the greatest, and no man will tell his brother, know the Lord, because they'll all know me? That promise still stands too. That is the promise made to the house of Israel and the house of Judah in the new covenant, in Jeremiah 31 and in Hebrews 8. So there's still even a future fulfillment of that promise. But every time, and this is what I'm driving at, every time you see the fulfillment in the Bible, it's to the people who had the promise in the first place. What you don't ever find in the Bible, if you just let it say what it says, is Gentiles receiving that specific promise. Therefore, all those books and all that theology and all that Israel replacement stuff that's based on that argument dissipates. Got it? Yes, sir.
You know, I was a Bible major in college and graduate school, and basically The underlying thing was that there is no theology in the Old Testament. So you don't go there and look at anything like this. It all is read retroactive from the New Testament. And that's how, of course, you get this horrible stuff that I believed myself at one time.
We should point out it was a Church of Christ University.
I'm just trying not to say that.
And yes, but that's important because they were also...
The Bible, but not the Old Testament.
Right. And that's why not only were they circumventing the Old Testament, but that they were also indoctrinating you in amillennial thought.
Absolutely.
And so you have to get rid of those kind of Old Testament promises, and you have to be able to use phraseology like New Israel and the Church of Gentiles has the fulfillment of New Israel. You have to be able to push those concepts onto the New Testament that aren't in there, and the way to do it is the nefarious way that I just described.
The Church of Christ in Alma?
Oh, yeah.
Dramatically.
I was on Alma.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So if the Jews, the believing Jews, become a royal priesthood, what about the believing Gentiles? Do they get that even though it wasn't promised to them or not?
Yes, absolutely. We do absolutely have that. We have all the benefits of the new covenant, but we don't have the promise of being a royal priesthood. And so that's the only point I'm making. Do we have the right to go to pray to God individually? Yes, absolutely. But the language of priest and priesthood and law and animals and sacrifice and temple, that's all Jewish language. And so there's no reason to use that kind of language to a Gentile audience because it's meaningless. But my point is, Peter, writing to a Jewish audience, can use that language, and it all resonates to them because that is their history.
Right. So in a sense, we get the benefits even though we may not understand what those benefits are.
Yeah, we get the benefits because we're under the new covenant, which is why I keep talking about the grace, grace, grace aspect of it, is that we as Gentiles are brought into a covenant that was never ours to start with.
The
new covenant is promised to the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And yet we are brought into it by an act of absolutely astounding grace. But to the Israelites, they have all these promises that are being fulfilled in the new covenant. And that's what Peter's arguing. That's what Peter's talking about. Peter is saying, now that Christ has come and died and resurrected and gone back to the Father, and the new covenant is starting to flourish among Israel, we're seeing that promises made to Israel are coming true. That's his point. And he's not even thinking Gentile at this moment.
Right.
Now, so do we gain those benefits? Oh, yes, marvelous grace we do. But Peter's point is not anything to do with Gentiles. So all of that theology that says, look how the Gentiles received Israel's promises, is just confusing.
Right.
Something else? Yes, ma'am.
The amillennial thing. What is that? We're trying to discuss it without interest.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, all right. Sure, we're here.
I was about to say, are you done with what you were going to cover tonight?
I guess I am. If you look at the eschatology series on our website, but I'm going to answer your question tonight anyway, because I'm in a good mood. But if you go on there, there's not only an explanation of what amillennialism is, but there's the history of amillennialism, the development of amillennialism, and then I have 16 hours of responding to amillennial theologians, reading their documents, and then talking about how they develop their theology. So there's plenty to find out on there. Do you know what millennia is?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start with words. Millennia means 1,000, right? Mm-hmm. A millennium is 1,000 years.
I know what the 1,000 years mean. I don't know what the amillennial.
Well, that's why I was making sure you knew what the root word was.
Okay.
1,000 years, Revelation 20, 1,000 years,
yes.
Right? Okay. So, M-I-L, that stands for millennial. If you believe that Christ is going to return for his church and take his church to heaven, marriage supper of the Lamb, all the stuff that is described in Revelation 19, if you believe that Revelation 19 comes before Revelation 20, if you believe that what's described in Revelation 19 takes place and then Revelation 20 takes place, if you believe that those things are sequential, which they are, then you believe that Christ is coming back before the 1,000 years that is described in Revelation 20. Therefore, you're referred to as pre-millennial. Okay? Now, there's this wonderful little tool in the Greek language where you can use the alpha, which has just made its way into our language as a letter A, the alpha stuck in front of just about any word turns that word 180 degrees in the opposite direction. And we still do that in the English language. Like when you're looking at patients, if you have a patient who comes in who's not showing any symptoms, you call him asymptomatic. Right? So we still use that little tool where we put A in front of a word and negate the word. Well, in theological parlance, we use that too. A theist is someone who believes in God. Someone who doesn't is a
atheist.
We just stuck the A in front of theist, and no, I don't believe in God. A Gnostic is someone who knows. Stick the A in front of it, we just pronounce it agnostic, don't know. Okay, well, there is, within the Reformed tradition and within the history of the church, starting all the way back at basically Augustine, and there is a message in our archives called Augustine's Amillennialism that traces this history. There were a lot of reasons, political reasons, for Augustine to argue and for his followers to argue that the 1,000 years spoken of in Revelation 20 is not a literal 1,000-year period where Christ is reigning on the earth, but that what's being described in Revelation 20 is the period of time from Christ's resurrection until his eventual return. And that everything you read in Revelation 20 that is described by the term 1,000 years, which is used 6 times, everything in there is actually describing the history of the church for the period that Christ is in heaven, and then he's going to come back to get his church. Well, if that's the case, then it's been 2,000 years since he was gone. So therefore, 1,000 years doesn't mean 1,000 years. Its meaning changes to large expanse of time. Therefore, you don't believe in a literal 1,000 years, so you are amillennial. And that's where the word comes from. It means no literal 1,000 years. That theology was the primary theology of the Catholic Church through the 1,000 years that we refer to lovingly as the Dark Ages. And when the Reformers came on the scene, their primary arguments with the Catholic Church in their attempts to reform the Catholic Church, and therefore the word reformers and reformation, the primary argument had to do with, is salvation an act of works? Do you do your works and your penance and your mass and everything to be saved? Or is it an act of grace? And that's where Luther really began, that the just shall live by faith, salvation by grace through faith. That became the primary theological argument of the Reformation. So when you talk about Luther, when you talk about Calvin, when you talk about Zwingli, they never discussed, argued, wrote about eschatology, end time things. It was all about soteriology, how are people saved? And so it is true historically that Calvin and Luther and Zwingli were historically amillennial, because that was what they had grown on, that's what they'd been taught, that's what the church at large was teaching at that point in time. So within the Reformed camp, if you are a strict adherent to Reformed theology, Calvinistic Reformed theology, then you're going to be amillennial almost by default. And because so much of premillennialism has taken this sort of really extreme Hal Lindsey, John Hagee, sensationalistic view, there are a lot of folks who, when they leave their Arminian theology and embrace Reformed theology, end up, in order to be fully Reformed, embracing amillennialism. So amillennialism has become the default position of the Reformed Church. I, on the other hand, it was my study of eschatology for years that made it easy for me to adopt and understand and recognize and embrace a completely sovereign God. Because my thinking was, any God who can predict the future in advance, tell you exactly how it's going to go, he's in charge. So when I first heard the theology of sovereignty, I went, well, that's the God I already know from eschatology. But my eschatology was premillennial. So I did not reform my eschatology when I came to embrace the doctrines of grace. Instead, I saw the doctrines of grace as working hand in glove with premillennial theology. Now, I'm not the only one. There are lots of folks who feel this way. If you are a John MacArthur fan at all, John MacArthur is premillennial sovereign grace. And he just recently really shook up a lot of the preachers at the most recent Shepherd's Conference because he stood up and said that if you are sovereign grace, reformed, Calvinistic, that the only eschatology that makes sense is premillennial, which is what I've been arguing for years. Well, of course, that really upset all the Amel reformed guys because they said, no, well, then you're not truly reformed because truly reformed means, but as I always argue, even the reformers' motto was always reforming. It was not their intention that what they believed would then get set in stone and that would become the reformed theology forever. They wanted the church to continue digging and reforming itself to bring it into accordance with the word. So those are the two primary positions, premillennial, amillennial. In great big sweeping terms, premillennialism is usually associated with more Arminian theology because of the Hal Lindsey, John Hagee connection. And amillennialism is usually connected with Reformed theology because of the Calvin-Luther connection. I don't care. I only care what the Bible says, and I only care what I can defend from the Bible. Therefore, I'm premillennial, Reformed sovereign grace, and that makes me an unusual package. But it's also, by the way, the package that Jeff Young was the first time he called me and said, so really, you're Reformed Calvinistic? Yes. And you're premillennial? Yes. Yes, I am. So am I. And now I can't get rid of him. So those kind of connections. David Morris, D.J. Ward, and by the way, Spurgeon, all premillennial sovereign grace. And Alex, and pretty much everybody in this room. Yes, ma'am.
How do all the Amel people justify their stance?
Easy.
I mean, when it's in black and white right here.
No.
Interpretation. You know, it all stands on interpretation. So I'll tell you what, rather than engage in all that, there's so much material already on the website. Now that I've given you the big overview, if you want the details, go back and listen to some of those. Tracks. Pardon me?
I didn't know there was any. I was completely ignorant that there was any dispute.
Anything other than premillennialism, huh? Well, there's another view, long as we're confusing you. There's also something called postmillennialism. Now, postmillennialism is the idea that the 1,000 years, which becomes called like the golden age, which is not a biblical term, but they would refer to it as that the 1,000 years in Revelation 20 actually represents, again, that time between Christ leaving and coming back, but that what it describes is the world getting progressively better, 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 until the church triumphant essentially takes over the governments of the world, and the whole world becomes Christianized or at very least subject to the laws of God, and then Christ comes back to receive the kingdom that is already established on earth. So he comes back after the golden age, post-millennialism. And that view really got a hold in America as we built toward, you know, American industrialization and the greatest country in the world and the riches of it and everything else, and then World War I. And that idea that the world is getting better, better, better was kind of hard to hold on to. World War I, of course, was called the war to end all wars until World War II. And so by the end of World War II, you don't find a lot of postmillennialism. You find people kind of going, okay, now my eschatology ain't working. And those folks then sort of defaulted to amillennialism because they still believed that Revelation 20 was describing that period between Christ's resurrection and return, but instead of seeing it through those rosy colored glasses of everything's going to get better, they saw it as, well, he'll be back, but everything's going to get worse. So there's pre, there's post, there's ah. And there's a fourth position called panmillennialism. Whenever you have this discussion with preachers, somebody will say, I'm a panmillennialist. I figure it'll all pan out. Yeah, I know. What was that? Bucket of fish. And so, yeah, so I've never enjoyed that particular view. Yes, ma'am? What?
She said something about dispensationalism. I don't know what she's talking about.
Okay. That's an easy one. Among premillennialists, there's what's called historical premillennialism, or there's what's called dispensationalism. Dispensationalism is what you would find if you have a Scofield Reference Bible. Dispensationalism is what I most often get lumped in with, because people will say, if you see a distinction between Israel and the church, as I do, and which I just argued for 20 minutes ago, they'll say, well, then you're a dispensationalist, because that's what dispensationalism continues to argue, is distinction between Israel and the church, and that the promises made to Israel in the Old Testament are going to be given to Israel in the New Testament, all of which I believe. Unfortunately, dispensationalism gets its name from the concept that God has dealt with human beings in seven definite dispensations of time. And under each of those dispensations, God dealt with people in a unique way. There was the Adamic dispensation, the time of innocence, and he dealt with people that way. There was the Noahic dispensation, and he dealt with the people during the time of Noah. And there was the Abrahamic dispensation. He dealt with those people. And then there was the period of law. And then there was the period of the church and the new covenant. Then there's going to be the millennium. And then there's going to be the age to come. And so they see seven distinct dispensations that have God dealing with people in seven distinct ways. But I don't buy that.
Sounds like God changing.
It does. And that's one of the many problems with it. But I see the Abrahamic covenant as being an overarching covenant that from the time of its inception makes its way all the way into the new covenant, which is exactly what Paul argues in Galatians. And so therefore, dispensationalism doesn't work. But I get called that a lot because I see distinction between Israel and the church. Dispensationalism then becomes a hermeneutic, a way to read the Bible. If you're thinking in terms of seven dispensations, you're going to read the Bible that way. And that's why I don't like systems like those. I try to avoid those kind of systems.
Come up with your own system.
Called
Plank of Wood,
which is why he has the t-shirt. So there you go.
Okay, what was between law and new covenant of the seven? You said Adam, Noah, Abraham, law, then what?
Church. Millennium, age to come. All of that stuff is the result of 2,000 years of theological development. It is necessary for amillennialism to work for you to believe that starting at chapter 20, verse 1, it is the beginning of a recapitulation, and that now John, for some reason, at the end of chapter 19, at the beginning of what we call chapter 20, which John didn't think in chapters, and despite the fact that it begins with Chi, a connecting statement, you're supposed to believe that for some reason, as you're reading through chapter 19, chapter 20 starts, and it's a recapitulation of old stuff now. And there's no way to read it in the text, the English text or the Greek text. Somebody has to tell you that in order for you to read it that way. So again, it's the product of theological development. And so is dispensationalism, admittedly. So is covenantalism. But you can go back and see that in the earliest church, for the first 300 years of the church, the primary millennial view was what was called kiliasm, because kiliad, Greek for 1,000, premillennialism was the primary view for the first 300 years of the church. And then, you know, development begins, and that development is based on politics as much as it's based on theological necessity. So you got to go back and study all that history, too, to see why all these systems develop. I try to avoid systems as much as possible, read what it says, and if what it says pushes me into a corner, I'm fine with that. If what it says in Revelation 26 times 1,000 years, then I'm going to go with it means 1,000 years. That's consistent with my overall hermeneutic, which is let the Bible say what it says. Make sense? Okay.
Okay, how does plank of wood differ from dispensationalism?
Oh, my.
That's too big a piece.
No, it's fine. I'll tell you why. Plank of wood. So you've got these two hermeneutic systems. You've got dispensationalism, seven distinct dispensations, or you've got covenantalism, which says that ever since the fall, there's only been one covenant by God, and different administrations, that's the exact language they use, different administrations of that self-same covenant. So they see one overarching covenant. Dispensationalism sees seven distinct, unique periods of time. They're both wrong. Where the law is concerned, the law and the new covenant are distinct. So to that degree, dispensationalism. Abrahamic covenant began and continues into the new covenant. So to that degree, I'm covenantal. So that's why I don't like systems. If you hear me talking about the Abrahamic covenant and the overarching effects of the Abrahamic covenant, you're going to say, that guy's covenantal. If you hear me talking about the law versus the new covenant, law versus grace, you're going to say, that guy's dispensational. What I am is biblical. And so for lack of a name, I ended up with plank of wood because every other name had been taken. I was trying to find the most innocuous name for what I believe that I could find. So I just went with plank of wood.
So where plank of wood and covenantalism agree is that you both believe in the new covenant.
And see the ongoing effects of the Abrahamic covenant. That's the overarching covenant. The overarching covenant, they think, is a covenant of grace that began back with Adam after the fall, after Adam's fall. I don't see any such covenant. They also say that there's a covenant of works formed with Adam. I don't find that in the Bible anywhere. Yes, ma'am.
So new covenant theology is what we would believe is that we're not, whenever we refer to Israel in the Bible, it's not talking about the Gentiles too, it's just that we are included in the promise though. But whenever they're specifically talking about Israel, they're not saying the Gentiles too. It's when he's talking about his chosen people, he's talking about all of us at that time, the Gentile believers and the Jewish believers. Is that correct?
Let me put it this way to you. I believe that God is specific, and when he uses specific language, he means it specifically. Okay. And where you get into trouble is when you look at a word like Israel and say, that means something different now. Doesn't mean Israel. Doesn't mean those national people. So it means all believers. Or it means the church, or it means something else. Now, you just used the word New Covenant theology. You said, well, then New Covenant theology, that's another system that I've walked away from and said, okay, now I'm not New Covenant. Because New Covenant, as it's defined by Sound of Grace and John Riesinger and those folks, replaces the church with Israel. So I can't use that terminology either.
Okay, I misspoke.
So when we're looking at the New Testament, we've got to understand who the audience is that the individual writers are writing to. For instance, this is really important. You read the book of Galatians and you have Paul saying that we, the church, Gentiles, he calls us the seed of Abraham by faith. And he says that Abraham was justified by faith. And then he says that justification before God is justification through faith without the works of the law. Right? Then you go read the book of James. And James writes, Abraham was justified by his works. Okay, we have an enormous conflict in the Bible now. If they're both writing to the same audience, it's schizophrenic. And so, boy, you can find books and books and books trying to explain it. And they'll say, well, what it means is Paul was saying that justification before God is a matter of faith, but justification before other men is what James was talking about, because he says, show me your faith and I'll show you my faith by my works. Therefore, James is talking about justification before men. But that's not what he says. He says Abraham is justified by works. He's talking about justified before God. Okay, now that's either going to make your head explode if you believe that the Bible has one author and the author is the Holy Spirit and God is consistent with himself, or it's two different audiences, two different groups. One of whom we read in the book of Acts, the Jews in Jerusalem, it says that they were zealous for the law and they were believers in Christ. Paul bumped into them when he went back and shaved his head and took a vow and went into the temple. That's what James and the Jerusalem council argued and said, you see how many believing Jews there are that are zealous for the law. That's a completely different group than Paul was writing to in Galatia when he said, don't be circumcised, don't begin to keep the law, because if you start down that road, you're responsible for the whole law and you're going to be condemned. So two different groups, two different arguments, and then there's no conflict. So, said all that to say, can God say to the Israelites in Exodus, if you do things my way, if you believe me, follow my rules, I'll make you a kingdom of priests? And then Peter can pick it up writing to Israelites. and say, you believing Jews, you believing Israelites, you are a kingdom of priests. And have no conflict there at all because it's the same descendants of the people who had that promise to begin with. The confusion happens when people don't see those distinctions. And if you do, the Bible clears right up.
Amil means there is no future restoration for Israel.
Absolutely.
That's where the replace Israel, the church has replaced Israel, means there is no more future promises to fulfill for Israel.
Right. Okay, now this is really good. I'm glad you brought that up because this is really good. Am I just boring the heck out of you people or is this all right? It's really good that you brought that up because God just said to Israel, if you'll keep my laws and statutes, you will be a kingdom of priests. So there's a big if connected to it because the law is a conditional promise. Everything he promises Israel is, if you'll do it my way, I'll make you a great nation. I'll take you into your land. I'll protect you. If you don't do it my way, I'll curse you, I'll scatter you, I'll disperse you. Well, what's their history? They don't do it. And he does curse them and disperse them and put them into bondage, and all of that happens. And if that had been everything the Old Testament had to say about it, then the church replacement Israel people would be right in saying, well, it was conditional. They didn't keep the conditions, and God wrote them off. The problem is, the promise of the new covenant says, I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not like the covenant I made with them when I took them out of the land of Egypt, which covenant they broke. So God knows they broke that covenant and still says, I'm going to make a new covenant with them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people.
So is that their argument, that they're making a new covenant, that the church is included in that new covenant?
Yes.
Yeah, essentially. The argument is Israel nationally gave up their rights because it was a conditional promise from God. They didn't keep the conditions, so God scattered them, and he's finished with them. Okay. And you say, well, what about all these other promises? They say, it doesn't matter. Those are conditional. But the new covenant's not conditional. It's based on the Abrahamic covenant. It's not conditional. Just let the text say what it says. Then you got to say that the house of Israel and the house of Judah, though they broke the law, though God has scattered them around the world and they've lost their heritage and lost their promised land, nevertheless, they're going to have all that again someday because God said, I'm going to make a new covenant with those selfsame people. Why? Because I'm God and they're my people and I promised it to them, which is why Paul in Romans 11, that very controversial section, but if you understand all that, it makes complete sense when Paul says that after the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, then all Israel will be saved. And then describing what he means by all Israel, he says, as touching the gospel, they're enemies for your sakes, for the sake of the believing Gentiles. Enemies of the gospel. It was exactly Israel's state when he was writing that. And then he says, but as touching the election, they are beloved for the Father's sake. And that's the reason why all Israel will be saved. Completely sensible in light of the new covenant, rightly understood.
Well, it's interesting from a Reformed position, when God said to them, if you do this, I will blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
He didn't say, but you know, if you don't, I will anyway. But he did mean that. But he couldn't say that then. Yeah, but it's really interesting because the implication, he lets people imply what he's saying, but he can't nullify the Abrahamic covenant.
Can't nullify the covenant. Who made the Abrahamic covenant?
God by himself.
God by himself. How do you nullify that covenant?
Can't, because he cannot deny himself.
Isn't that exactly what Paul argues in the book of Galatians?
Yes.
That you can't nullify that. That covenant's good.
Yeah, he doesn't go back to the Mosaic. He goes back to the Abrahamic.
He even argues that the Mosaic covenant came and left.
Right.
But never nullified the Abrahamic covenant because it was based on promise, not on works, not on law. We have wandered so far tonight. But I hope you got something out of all that because I'm going to wrap it up and let you go home. These are great big categories. I'm glad you asked if you were confused about those terms. I'm glad you asked and we had a chance to go through all that. But the main point I wanted to drive tonight was, to understand the Bible, you have to understand who's writing, who they're writing to, and then what they say. And if a Jewish writer is writing to Jews saying that a Jewish promise has been fulfilled among the Jews, good! There's no confusion there. And that's exactly what you find in 1 Peter. Got that? That was a long way around to get to that point. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so Frank would put a similar covenantalism because it emphasizes the Abrahamic covenant, and it's similar to dispensationalism because it's pre-mill.
Because it sees a distinction between the law and the new covenant, which would be like two separate dispensations. And we see a future millennium before, you know, the new age. And so that sounds like, as soon as you say that you see a future millennium, they'll say, oh, dispensation. But I try so hard to avoid all those.
What does plank of wood mean?
Are what?
Are they pre-mill?
Yes. Dispensationalism are pre-mill by default.
Wait a minute.
What does plank of wood mean? Not a thing.
It doesn't?
I just got so tired of using names that then people would adopt. For a while, I called myself New Covenant, and then, you know, Riesinger grabbed that name and wrecked it, so I can't call myself that anymore. So I got so tired of using names that had all this theological baggage connected to them. I said one night here, years ago, during the eschatology series, I said, I need a name for my theology, so I'm going to call it Plank of Wood, because nobody else used that name.
You know, if you have
that's all it means. Yeah, and it turns out the plank of wood is an acronym, POW, POW. And that, no, I didn't
know. If you have to name a system, yeah, that will become, to borrow from the movie, the lens you look at the Bible, and you will become a slavish devotee to cram everything.
Right, right.
But really, what you just said in Galatians blows both of them out of the water.
Right.
Because in a sense, it's covenantal, Abrahamic covenantal, but it's, you know.
That's the point. Any time that you become a slave to your system, which is what I argue. If you go back and you listen to some of the articles that I read by some of the leading amillennialists, one of the things that I kept pointing out was how slavishly they follow their system despite what the Bible says. And they interpret passages where they'll quote a passage and then say, it means this. And their meaning and what the words say are two entirely different things. But they need that meaning for their system to be accurate. And so I'm not a fan of hermeneutic systems. We all have them, I suppose. But if you're a slave to your system, you'll end up making the Bible bend and mold to fit your system. I'd much rather stand toe-to-toe with what it says. Whatever system develops out of that, okay, fine. And whatever pigeonhole I end up in as a result, fine. But I'm going to stand by what the word says. Make sense?
Yep.
Okay. Am I done yet?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org